You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there, and thank you for downloading The Agenda's podcast. From today, it is the 24th of June. And our big focus on the programme today was this announcement from the World Health Organization. Now, they are warning patients to watch out for specifically fake versions of Ozempic. Now, we found out more about that problem. We considered how we're being kept safe here in the UAE from fake drugs and how you can be sure that all the drugs you're taking are actually real. It was a really interesting conversation. We spoke to several experts, and so make sure you listen through to that. Meanwhile, researchers have found wild chimpanzees actually self-medicate for injury or sickness by using special plants that either have pain-relieving or antibacterial properties. We found out more with the researcher, the primatologist behind that study. And Booking.com is warning of an up to 900% increase in travel scams. Before you book your holiday, we wanted to get advice, so consumer advocate Adam Glazer joined us to tell us how you can keep yourself safe while booking a break. And a family in Florida say they are suing NASA after a piece of space junk from the International Space Station narrowly avoided hitting their son as it crashed through their roof. So how likely are we to be hit by space junk on Earth? Expert Luke Piguet from Clear Space reassured us. Well, actually, he didn't really, but he tried to reassure us. And finally, elephants apparently call each other by name. The lead author of that study explained how it sounds. Okay, we're going to turn our attention straight away to that story out from the World Health Organization, who are warning patients to watch out for fake versions of Ozempic. Now, I think everyone knows what Ozempic is now, but if you don't, it is a drug that's become very popular as a way of losing weight. Huge global enthusiasm for the drug now. People are, I think it's okay for me to say that people are genuinely using it as a sort of lose weight, sort of quick fix. And then you've got other people who are obese and have really struggle with their weight and have got life-threatening issues who are using it to great effect and resolving many, many different health problems. I mean, I think it's become quite a political subject in some ways. And I think that if I was going to come down on one side of the fence, I would be very firmly in favour of it. I think it's absolutely brilliant. But it does sometimes lead to shortages for type 2 diabetes patients who actually need it to control the amount of sugar that they have in their blood. And the thing is that it's become so popular that there's a shortage. And the World Health Organization says that if you're taking a counterfeit medicine, then it could pose a real danger to health. They've pointed out that people should only source the drug through reputable sources. That's your doctor. You shouldn't be going online. You shouldn't be doing it through social media. I mean, it sounds obvious, doesn't it? But the problem is that people are super desperate to get hold of it. Because, you know, if you're told you can lose a couple of kilos in a week, then it must be, you know, it's just one injection. You'd feel pretty tempted to do it. But the World Health Organization's experts say they have actually been tracking rising reports of dodgy Ozempic. They've been doing it all around the world since 2022, and they've seized fake batches in the UK, the US, and Brazil. So I did a bit of reading about this over the weekend, and it turns out that Ozempic isn't the only drug being faked. In fact, studies show that 10.5% of all medications worldwide are either subpar or counterfeit. And it's actually worse in your lower and middle income countries. There, the incidence of fake medicines was around 13.6%. So let's find out a bit more about it. Earlier, I spoke to pharmaceutical expert Oksana Pysyk. Now, she's an executive board member of the Fight the Fakes Alliance. She said that this warning, this specific warning out of the World Health Organization, was not unexpected.
This was not a surprise at all, because what we tend to see is that as soon as there is a drug shortage of any kind, so if we look back to during the pandemic, all the COVID-19 related products, anything from diagnostics, treatment, vaccines, even PPE, there were falsified versions of this because there was a run on it. And that meant the price and the profit to be made goes up. So as soon as there is a higher demand, we see that usually criminal organizations leverage that to be able to target what the next hot item is. And we have seen for years now that with the widening use of semaglutide, the active ingredient in Ozempic, and other products similar to that, that they become so popular, it's difficult to get in your local pharmacy. As a result, there is opportunity for very sophisticated falsified medical products to enter the legal supply chain. That's what the WHO alert was about. And other more opportunistic people are posting it on less legitimate forums like social media. And in that instance, who knows what you're getting.
Overall, how widespread is the production of counterfeit medicines and drugs?
It's estimated to be worth about $200 billion. So the whole counterfeit industry, again, is more profitable than many other illicit trades. In certain settings, we see on average, particularly in low-income settings, where it's more difficult to access medicines, it's about 1 in 10 medicines, according to the World Health Organization. Now, in high-income countries, this number tends to be lower because we have a more secure pharmaceutical supply chain. But again, whenever there is a shortage, the greater opportunity for these to leak in.
So I've noticed that I get quite a lot of these sort of spam style emails offering me various different types of medication. Is that very much part of the problem?
Online phishing attempts offering fake Ozempic, fake GLP-1 agonists to patients has increased by 183% in the first quarter of 2024 compared to the same period last year in 2023, according to the security company McAfee, who've been tracking this data. So again, if you're a consumer and you're getting emails about this, it's very likely that that's going to be another avenue towards accessing counterfeit products. So do not click, do not buy, only go to your pharmacist and doctor.
Do you know, I have to admit that this was not something that was on my radar at all until this World Health Organization report came out. And then I started doing a bit of research on it and I was looking for guests who could talk to us about it like yourself. And I had no concept of just how big a deal it is. And what's so interesting is that the drugs that they are selling, you know, they're not just sugar tablets, are they? They can actually be very bad for you.
Oh, absolutely. A whole range of things can occur. For one thing, there could be nothing in it. And if you need it for medical reasons, then there'll still be negative health results. Or it can contain toxins, contaminants, or completely other medications and what it says on the label. So for instance, there have been cases where people have gone to a social media site, they pick up what they think is Ozempic, it ends up containing insulin, which can be very dangerous if you are not a diabetic, for instance, and are using Ozempic, which in that case would be classified as Wegovy for weight loss, and you can go right into hypoglycemia, very low blood sugar, end up hospitalized. There are very severe complications that can result, including death. So it's really not worth your life to try and lose weight over a counterfeit product.
Who's actually making these counterfeit products? Is it organized crime?
Well, there are a range of how sophisticated the falsified products are. So if we go to the very rudimentary ones, these are ones that you can almost immediately visually identify that this is not a legitimate product. It may say something like not for human use on the label. There may be spelling errors. There could be smudges. That in its instance may be a smaller operation. And then we go to the most sophisticated counterfeit products that slip through into the legitimate supply chain. And these are virtually impossible to detect from the original version. And those more sophisticated ones are most certainly run by organized criminal groups. And they're able to run it at a mass level, a factory level, to be able to produce enough to meet that demand and make a significant profit doing so.
How do countries manage this? You know, it never occurs to me that when I go to the pharmacy here in the UAE that there could be a counterfeit medicine. And I'm sure here in the UAE, they have all sorts of, you know, precautions to make sure that they're not. But who does that responsibility fall to?
So every country will have their own regulator and they will have stipulations in which medical professionals, pharmacies, hospitals should all be purchasing from known and verified suppliers, that trusted sources. Again, when there is a shortage and it's difficult to get from your usual client, then sometimes people look for others. Generally, if the price is too good, that's an indication already. If it's heavily discounted, and we have had cases that in the US where medicines are extremely expensive, doctors trying to save for their clients and they think they're getting it from Canada. It ends up being a whole undercover operation, which has nothing to do with Canada, and it enters that way. I think the first step is to ensure that healthcare professionals are doing their due diligence in terms of sourcing from verified manufacturers, trusted sources. That's beyond the patient level. But as an individual, no one should be buying a prescription-only medicine without a prescription or going to a social media site or any kind of website that claims to be a pharmacy but does not ask for a prescription. So I think that the best thing you can do to protect yourself is to go via the legal channels. So go to your prescriber, your doctor, your pharmacist, get it from there. If you then see that the product doesn't match up to what you previously had, raise that with your prescriber. The chances of this are going to be very low. Where the highest risk is, again, is going to a unverified site. That could be social media. It could be pharmacy. A lot of online pharmacies around the world, every country will have a method of verifying that it's legit. So those are the two most important things. Again, if you suspect that you have a falsified product, the next thing you should do is not take it and go immediately to your pharmacist or doctor to have that checked out.
That, of course, is Oksana Pajzik there, executive board member of Fight the Fikes Alliance. Really fantastic to speak to her over the weekend. She's really sort of fleshed out the story there for us from a global perspective. Up next, we're actually going to look at the story more locally, but I'd really like to throw this out to you. I wonder if you've ever seen a fake medicine. I think it's pretty unlikely to have happened here in the UAE, but perhaps when you were abroad, did you go into a shop and think you were buying paracetamol, and then, you know, you could tell that the medicine itself or the packaging was fake. We're talking about that World Health Organization warning over Ozempic. Apparently, there's been fake batches of the drug doing the rounds all over the world, but in particular, they seized it in the UK. They've seized a batch in the United States and also in Brazil. Now, we all know that enthusiasm for the medicine has really soared in recent months, I suppose. Has it been more than a year now? I think it has. And it's basically because it's very effective at helping people lose weight. And as a consequence, you're getting your criminals moving into the market. But it's interesting that Ozempic isn't the only drug being faked. Studies show that 10.5% of all the medications worldwide are either considered subpar or they are actually fake. Here in the UAE, the Department of Health, as well as the Emirates Individual Public Health Department, apparently closely monitor for counterfeit medicines. The DOH, for example, uses a bar coding system. And then the Dubai Health Authority announced before COVID, actually, that they were introducing a special pharmaceutical track and trace system to monitor not just the medicines that are manufactured here, but also elsewhere along the supply chain. But nevertheless, I can imagine people might feel slightly concerned at hearing that story about Ozempic. So joining me now is Ali Hashimi. He's the CEO of GluCare, who regularly prescribe these types of medicines to people who are obese or who need them. And he joins me now on the line. Ali, how are you? Good morning to you. I suppose the obvious question is...
Good morning. How are you?
Hello. I am good. Thank you. Tell me, how do you make sure that your medicines are real? Because there must be some trust involving your supplier.
Acquire the medications directly. So we have our own pharmacy in the clinic itself, and we prescribe our medications from our own pharmacy. We manage our own supply chain extremely, extremely tightly.
And where do you get the medicines from before you have them in your pharmacy?
So the way all medications work in the UAE is typically there will be a global manufacturer of those medications, and they will almost always have to have a local distributor. That distributor is registered with the government to import and distribute those medications. And typically it will be one distributor that has an exclusivity over that particular medication.
So that's quite reassuring. It sounds like there's systems in place, and that's, you know, and there's trust involved, and there's professionals in the line, in the sort of trade line. line. Experts say that demand is driving the production of these counterfeit drugs. You know, where there's money to be made, the criminals, you know, will seek to exploit that opportunity. We've talked about this in the past, but are you still seeing shortages of these Ozempic-style drugs?
Yeah, intermittently. It's not as bad as it was before. And so in the case of Ozempic and Mounjaro and the weight loss drugs in general, getting to this question of counterfeits and fake drugs, it's actually a multi-layered conversation and not as straightforward as other drugs. In the case of Ozempic, for example, because there was a global shortage of the medication, the FDA has actually put it on a whitelist of medications due to shortage that compounding pharmacies are allowed to make it in parallel with the original manufacturer. And so what's interesting about these drugs, it's not actually the active ingredient that's in shortage. It's not the molecule itself, the peptide itself. It was more so the delivery mechanism, the syringe, that was difficult to produce in scale. And that's why largely the manufacturers were struggling to meet demand, is because they couldn't produce enough of these injectors. But the active ingredient, which is the peptide, semaglutide in Ozempic, one could acquire at bulk and then essentially reconstitute in a compounding pharmacy as an analog of Ozempic. The FDA was allowing this and is still, as far as I know, is still allowing it due to the global shortage of these medications. Now, not anyone can do this. You have to be a regulated and licensed compounding pharmacy meeting certain minimum quality obligations. Now, that obviously creates a little bit of confusion in this conversation around what is fake and what's not fake. So you do have semaglutide in the market produced by compounding pharmacies, which is legally allowed, let's say, by the FDA. It's not the branded drug that the original manufacturers would have produced, but it's not illegal. The problem is, layered on top of that, you have unsanctioned manufacturers and compounding pharmacies producing product and getting it into the supply chain. Because it now becomes a little bit of a gray area. And that's where you start worrying about impurities. You start worrying about whether or not these drugs actually contain any of the active ingredient that they are said to contain. So in the context of Ozempic, it's actually a little bit more of a complex situation. We don't face these issues here in the UAE because there's not this sort of parallel compounding path to getting the drugs. And that's why a lot of people in the UAE were affected with the shortages that happened over the last couple of years.
Really interesting to hear there about the complexity around this story. You know, the fact that those companies are allowed to compound companies are allowed to produce the drug and therefore you could end up finding it in slightly different packaging. Ali Hashmi, always lovely to have you join us on the line. Thank you very much indeed for your time this morning. Ali Hashmi there, the CEO of GluCare. Now, they are a clinic that prescribes the medicine. Worth mentioning that, of course, the World Health Organization says you should never get these medications anywhere other than via your doctor and a pharmacist. If you do see drugs or medicines that you think are fake, consumers can contact the Drug Information Service at the Department of Health. There's a hotline. It is 800-424, or you can also email them at PV, that's V for Victor, E, PVE, at doh.gov.ae. Attention to a really interesting science story. Researchers have found that wild chimpanzees apparently self-medicate for injury or sickness. They're using plants that either have pain-relieving properties, or they could even be antibacterial. It's incredibly clever. Scientists observing the animals in the forest of Uganda say that the chimps actually use detective work. They try out the different plants to figure out which ones seem to work. It's an amazing story. And joining me now to talk through the study is Dr. Ella D. Freeman. She's a primate behaviour expert at the Institute of Human Sciences at the University of Oxford. Ella D., thank you so much for joining me on the line. Tell me, how did you discover this? Were you looking for it? Did you suspect they did it? Or was it completely coincidental?
Yeah, thank you for having me. So I maybe was unusual in that I set out to go look for it. A lot of cases of self-medication are sort of coincidental, opportunistic. So researchers will be looking for some other behavior and they'll see something strange. But I've been fascinated with chimpanzee self-medication for years and years, and I decided to do my PhD on the topic. So I was out systematically looking for it, which is why we were able to, from the beginning, get together such a collaborative team to conduct kind of the the complicated science behind this paper.
Yeah, how did you figure it out? Because it's one thing to watch an animal put a paste, you know, chew something up and put a paste of it on there on a cut. But how do you then know, you know, what was in it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what we were doing on my side, so I'm a chimpanzee specialist primatologist. So I was in the field working with the chimpanzees, and the chimps I was working with were two different wild communities. So they're habituated to people, meaning they're used to researchers following them around, but they're wild. They're not in a sanctuary. They live in the forest and do whatever they want to do. And we are just sort of there, watching and observing and writing everything down. So on my side, I was looking for anything unusual that they were eating, anything unusual that they were doing. I was also monitoring their health to keep track of whether or not any of them had indicators of bacterial infection. In samples I was taking, I was keeping track of whether or not they had high parasite loads. And I was also looking for things like wounds or injuries. And that was sort of one side of the project. And after I had extracted 13 species that had a plant species that had sort of suspect uses during my time there, I was there for 8 months. I then brought those species to a laboratory in Germany, in New Brandenburg, where a colleague who's a pharmacologist then conducted a series of assays. So tests on those plants to see if they actually had medicinal properties.
And they did.
And they did, which was super exciting. And we tested them against a panel of different bacteria that are very kind of serious bacteria that have serious implications for humans. So 88% of them showed strong growth inhibition against those bacteria, which means they stopped those bacteria from growing, which is a very exciting result. And 33% of them, so fewer, but 33% of them showed strong anti-inflammatory effects, so which have implications for wound healing. And that was really, you know, it was exciting in many ways. It was surprising because how cool we found a bunch of these new, you know, bioactive plants in the chimpanzee diet. But on the other hand, not surprising, chimps are incredibly intelligent. They're very well aware of their forest environments. They've lived and grown in the forests, unlike, you know, many of us. So it's not surprising that they would know what to keep them healthy in a forest full of diseases and pathogens.
I mean, this is a big step, my next question, but do you think that this knowledge is passed on between chimps, or are they trying stuff out every time?
It's another great question. So this is still a gap in the field, which I find very exciting. I think to me, this is the big next question in the field of non-human animal self-medication. What we know right now is that there are some sort of simplistic behaviors, more simple behaviors that don't involve chemical compounds. They're behaviors that the actual morphology of the leaf, for example, will have anti-parasitic effects. Behaviors like that, I think, are more likely to be instinctual. And there's some studies that suggest that there's an instinctual component. I think when we're talking about pharmacologically active species, because chimpanzee habitats are so varied across, you know, where different chimpanzee communities live, it seems impossible to me that there would be an instinctual component to identify a specific plant species and eat it at a specific dose. I think there could be elements of instinct, but I absolutely think, though this hasn't been proven yet, I think that there is an element of social transmission, social learning, and possibly even culture.
I mean, it's so exciting. Amazing to hear there about how the animals are managing to sort of self-medicate. And oddly enough, later on in the program, we're going to be talking about another extraordinary discovery that suggests that elephants actually have names for each other. So a bit of a theme on our program today. But Dr. Elodie Freeman, thank you very much indeed for your time on the agenda this morning. Really fantastic to hear about that amazing research. And I hope you get to carry on with it. Dr. Elodie is a primate behavior expert at the Institute of Human Sciences at the University of Oxford. Thank you very much. Looking at a really sort of relevant story for all of us right now, because apparently travel scams have increased between 500% and 900% in the past 18 months. 500 to 900%. I mean, I don't think I can even get my head around that figure. And it's according to the team at booking.com, who I use all the time. I regularly book hotels through them. Now, their internet safety boss, Marnie Wilkin, says there's been a particularly marked increase in phishing.
So, of course, we've had phishing since the dawn of email, but the uptick started shortly after ChatGPT got launched. Where you can, whether it's booking.com or whatever websites you're using, use two-factor authentication. And I know it can be a little bit painful to set up, and then you have to remember which phone it's on and everything. MFA is still hands down the best way to combat phishing and credential stealing.
That is Marnie Wilking there, of course, internet safety boss at booking.com. Now, I'm sure we all know what phishing attacks are, but essentially the gist of them is to convince people to hand over their card details or their personal details. And that is done through sending them fake but very convincing looking internet booking links. And because of AI and because of the sort of increasing sophistication of tech, you can now, you know, these scammers can make emails look like they're from booking.com, or they can make them look like they're from other travel companies, you know, like Airbnb. And apparently scammers are often targeting those types of websites. And after someone pays up, essentially the scammers vanish without trace. And they don't just leave the buyer out of pocket. They then turn up in the country and they don't have anywhere to stay. So, I mean, that's a holiday ruiner just there. Let's be honest. Okay, so as we all look to book our holidays this season, and I know many of people leave it very late, that is the nature of the UAE. How can we avoid actually getting caught out? Joining me now is Adam Glazer. He's a consumer advocate. He's based in Australia. Joins me now on the line. Adam, I'm sure you've heard of these types of situations in the past of people getting scammed out of money when they're booking a holiday.
Regularly, absolutely.
And is carry on.
I was going to say, it is definitely becoming more common. The more sophisticated the scams are, the more people that get caught out.
It's so interesting that Booking.com have come out and, you know, fessed up, essentially, because, of course, their website has been targeted in the past, as in people using their identity has been a real scam in the past.
Yeah, and it just shows how bad the situation is, the fact that Booking.com have come out and... have come out and said that they're being targeted, because you would imagine it would make people think twice before booking with them. But the situation's obviously got dire with their site.
What would you recommend people do? Because I have to say, I mean, we've got our holiday pretty much booked, but I do all my booking myself online.
You've got to be over diligent. If you're going to be giving your credit card details over the internet, what I tend to do is I'll normally call first to, if they've got a phone number, the business that I'm dealing with, I'll call first to make sure that the link has actually come from them, because so many of them these days are so realistic and it's so easy to get caught out. And as soon as you give over those credit card details, you can be in a lot of trouble.
So what seems to happen with Booking.com is that you might register with them and you might have an account with them, and then hackers or phishers will, or with the phishing scammers, will get in touch with you and pretend they're from Booking.com. Is that how it's been working out?
Yeah, I believe so. They'll say they're from Booking.com and they've got to confirm bank details, for example, and they ask you to do that online. For me, that's a red flag straight away. I will always firstly check the email that it's coming from. And at times from scammers, you'll find that emails are not the same as what you would be obviously receiving from Booking.com. But I will always call them too, because they do have a phone number, and just to verify that it came through from them. It's always safer to be over diligent than being scammed. And even if you look at it might be a waste of time, it's better than having your credit card details going who knows where.
I mean, ultimately, there's a certain amount of trust involved whenever you're booking, especially if you're booking a villa to rent elsewhere. You know, if you're going through one of these Airbnb type websites, I suppose you can also look at the reviews in that situation, you know, and check that other people have stayed at the property and it looks like, you know, it's a real going concern and not just a complete fake.
That's true. And like with Airbnb, for example, the money should be going through Airbnb naturally rather than to the place, the villa that you're renting the property from. And if they're asking you to give your details online, which, as I said, always makes me nervous, just like it does with most people, you can always give Airbnb a call and just ask if the link that you've been sent is 100% legitimate. And you can only do what you can do. But it's unfortunately these days, they're so sophisticated, the scammers, that they're catching out so many people. I found that they do target a lot of the elderly population, because back when they were a little bit younger, there was no internet. There were no mobile phones. So these things certainly weren't as much of an issue. And they would also be targeting younger people based on them potentially being slightly naive and not doing their due diligence. But you've really got to double check everything these days, especially when it comes out to giving out personal information.
I suppose one of the main issues after you've been scammed is that there isn't much protection for consumers if you have been foolish and given away your information.
There's not. Look, if you have been caught out, the best thing you can do is call your bank directly and see if there is anything that can be done. But normally when you've given your details out, the best thing that you can do is put a stop on your credit card, and goodness knows how much would have been taken out of there by that stage.
It is very worrying indeed, and certainly sort of clear lines of vigilance are what we all need to be focusing on. Adam Glazer there, consumer advocate based in Australia, thank you so much for giving us the rundown there on how you can stay safe when booking your holiday. Very interesting indeed that booking.com have come out and admitted that they've seen travel scams increase by such a huge number in the past 18 months. That's between 500% and 900%. A truly staggering number. I'm trying to think how I've booked my holiday. I've been through Airbnb. I've booked a little villa in Spain via Airbnb. I'm trying to think how I was sure that it was for real. I think I do check the reviews. And like Adam said, the money goes to Airbnb first rather than direct to the homeowner. So I suppose that gives you a little bit of a chance. But yeah, if anyone sends you an email, I think the secret is don't click on the link. I think you just have to go direct through the website and book direct with them and not sort of go round the houses slightly. I think that's when the alarm bells should start running. If you have ever been scammed through because you've been booking some sort of travel, be it a villa or a hotel or a car or anything associated with a holiday, please do get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. If we share our experiences, and potentially we could help someone else from being caught out. We're going to turn to our second science story of the day, because it's emerged that wild African elephants may actually call each other by name. They use individualized calls. Have a listen to this. Researchers say sounds like that show that elephants learn, recognise and use individualised name-like calls to address each other. Dolphins and parrots, also known to do this, they actually mimic each other's calls to sort of address each other. But this study suggests that elephant language, and I do put that in inverted commas, might go even further. Now, earlier I spoke to the lead study author, Mickey Pardo. He's an animal behaviourist and a postdoctoral fellow at Cornell University in New York. And he explained why they undertook this study.
So we found that elephants address one another with individually specific calls. So that means that they use a different call to address different individual members of their family group, which is effectively equivalent to calling each other by name.
How did you find this out? Were you looking for it?
Yeah, we were looking for it. I had the idea for the project actually back in 2012 when I first read a paper showing that dolphins could do something similar. So that gave me the idea of maybe elephants do something like this as well. So we were looking for whether elephants had names for each other. And the way that we figured it out was first, we went and collected as many calls as we could from known callers, where we also were able to tell who the receiver was. In other words, who the call was addressed to. And then we trained a machine learning model to see if it could identify patterns in the data that allowed it to predict who a call was addressed to just from the sound patterns of the call. The idea being that if the calls have something like a name embedded in them, then the machine learning model should be able to learn a pattern that would allow it to predict who a call was addressed to just from the sound structure of that call. But if they don't have a name, then there would be nothing there for it to learn. So that was the first step. And we found that we could predict significantly better than just random guessing who a call was addressed to based on the sound structure of that call. And then the second part of the study was to play recordings back to the elephants and see how they would react. And we found that they reacted more strongly to a call that was originally addressed to them than to a call from the same caller that was originally addressed to someone else. So that meant that they could tell just by hearing a call if it was meant for them or if it was meant for a different member of their family, which strengthened our conclusion that these calls contain something like a name embedded within them.
I mean, that is just incredibly cool. What do the calls sound like? I don't really know what noise elephants make apart from the very loud sort of angry or shouty trumpeting.
Yeah, that's a good question. So most people, when they think of the call that an elephant makes, they think of trumpets. But actually, trumpets are not the most common call that elephants make. By far, most of the calls that elephants make are rumbles, which are these low-frequency rumbling calls. It sounds almost like thunder or like a truck engine, something very low and rumbling. And that's most of their communication. They produce these calls in almost every context. The calls themselves are actually very variable. They all sound like this sort of low-pitched rumble, but when you look at the calls closely, you realize that they're actually quite variable in structure. And that's where most of the interesting stuff in their communication is going on. I can't really imitate it. And frankly, even if I could, it wouldn't come through over the speakers of the phone because most commercially available speakers can't really reproduce frequencies in that range at all. You know, most of the energy in these calls is below 200 or 300 hertz. And even if you were standing right there in front of an elephant, you still wouldn't hear the full call because part of it is actually below the range of human hearing. So it sounds quite different to an elephant from the way that it sounds to us.
I mean, that is extraordinary. I had no idea that they were making sounds that we couldn't hear, you know, that's actually outside our human hearing. Can I ask, do all the elephants have a different call for each other, like almost like nicknames? Or do the elephants have the same call for the same elephant, like a name?
That is a very good question. And unfortunately, it's one that we were not able to answer definitively in this study. So we did one analysis, which seemed to show that different elephants do share the same name, or at least a very similar name for the same individual. But we did another analysis, which seemed to show the opposite. So first, we found that calls from different callers that were addressed to the same receiver were more similar on average than calls from different callers that were addressed to different receivers. So that suggests that different elephants, if not using the same name for the same receiver, are at least using similar names for the same receiver. But then we also tried to train a machine learning model to identify patterns in the calls that were specific to individual receivers, regardless of who the caller was. In other words, learn names that were shared across different callers for addressing the same individual. And the model was not able to do that. But the question is why? Why was it not able to learn that pattern? And there's two possibilities. One is that it's because different callers do not use the same name to address the same receiver. Maybe they use slightly similar nicknames, but they're not using the same name. But the other possibility is that it was simply a limitation of our data set.
For some reason, knowing that the elephants call each other by name is incredibly emotive. And I think your study is going to have quite far-reaching implications about how people feel about elephants. Is that because...
I hope so.
Yeah, I mean, is that because having names makes it clear that they're very intelligent?
You know, I think more than that, what it is that people have this tendency to identify more with, not just with animals, but with others in general, when they're more similar to us. And in fact, I think this is probably one of the greatest shortcomings of the human race, in a sense that it's easier for us to feel empathy for someone if they're more similar to us. And because of that, when we see other creatures exhibiting behaviors that remind us of what we ourselves do, it makes us feel a stronger connection to them.
Fascinating there to hear about how elephants actually call to each other individually. Totally changed my perspective on the animals. And if you enjoy this podcast, please do click subscribe so you never miss a single episode. Plus, remember, you can always get in touch with us. Just check out our social media. You can either go to Dubai Eye 1038 FM, that's on Instagram or Facebook, or you can check mine out at georgia.tolly. Thanks for listening. And remember, we are live every weekday morning from 10 a.m.